Classical teachers are allowed not to be tech savvy, right? I'm going to be talking a little bit about historical context synonymous, but that's a little bit misleading. The main goal of what I'll be talking about is we need our books to become three-dimensional and ways to make the books that we read in Omnibus properly three-dimensional. So that's the main theme. If you have the outline, it was just a backup. It's really everything that's here reproduced. I was worried there might be some technological snafu, and it looks like we're okay. So far. Okay, I don't know how much you know about Omnibus. I'm starting with the presumption that there's a fair amount of knowledge of Omnibus. How many of you are not very familiar with Omnibus? Okay. The Omnibus, I've got some books up here which you may want to look at. The Omnibus program actually is supposed to go through six cycles. Right now we have three, Omnibus 1, 2, and 3. Omnibus 1 is ancient, Omnibus 2 is medieval, Omnibus 3 is modern. It's basically our great books program. It goes through the great books with an emphasis upon theology, history, and literature. And the idea is that as you make it through the program, these three disciplines are balanced in the treatment of the great books. So one common question is, do you have a Bible class at Veritas? Or at a lot of classical schools that have followed the Omnibus program don't actually have Bible classes. Well, we actually read the Bible in the Omnibus program. So that would be obviously part of the theology and history, and at times literature as well. The goal of the Omnibus program is to make possible the emergence of a comprehensive Christian worldview. The worst thing that could happen is the Bible would be seen as a sideshow, that it kind of sweeps in at the end, is basically irrelevant to what's happening in history, theology, and literature, and then suddenly you bring it in and provide answers. We actually want it to be as integrated as possible into the curriculum. And if you're familiar with the Veritas grammar curriculum, the Bible and history cards, that's part of the goal of the Bible and history cards, as far as possible, to have these things coexist naturally. There's an assumption that the great ideas are best understood when they're examined in relationship to and in an open dialogue with these three disciplines. So instead of placing these disciplines in airtight compartments, we actually want to read these books in such a way that there's an open dialogue if you're reading Sense and Sensibility, Pride and Prejudice, with history and theology, so that books are never read just as literature books, just as history books, just as theology books. I apologize for coming back and forth. There's no other way to do it. And the presumption is that the great ideas are best understood when they're contextualized. And that's what I'm going to talk about a fair amount. They become contextualized automatically in the Omnibus program because they're read alongside all these other books. So there's the potential for them not to exist in airtight compartments in subjects that are separated from one another. So already there's the possibility for context, but I think there's still a need to provide further context. And that's what I'm going to talk about, how we can make these books three-dimensional, as three-dimensional as possible. And I would suggest that none of these books should be read in a cultural, historical, theological, or literary vacuum. In other words, as much as possible, you'd like those four elements to emerge as you're reading the books. And you'd like the books to be understood as comprehensively as possible. And I think I've got these books blocking. There we go. Okay. Ty, you didn't see that, by the way. There's a potential weakness in the curriculum. I've taught for 2 years Omnibus 2 and 5, which are both medieval cycles, and I've taught Omnibus 3 secondary as well. And I have heard the critique at times working on the phones at the press that the names, dates, and places, that if you had a history course, American history, you'd get all the names, dates, and places. And so one of the potential weaknesses of Omnibus is that we don't give the names, dates, and places. And there, it's built into the curriculum is the assumption that alongside not only the books that you're reading, but you would also read Spielvogel, for instance, which would provide a lot of those things. Ty and I have talked about this a fair amount, and we've called it the jelly. Ty named it the jelly. And what we mean by that is the things in between the books that tie them together. I don't know if jelly is the right image, is that? Jelly doesn't tie things together very well. But so how do kids get the names, dates, and places? When they're reading the books that they read. One of the things that I've been thinking about a lot is how do we carry over if kids are coming through the grammar curriculum and they've been drilling the Bible and history cards, how do we carry that over into Omnibus? But by what means do we do that? What are some techniques or methods for doing that? One of the things that we've considered is putting the Bible and history cards up on the wall at the beginning of the year, creating a timeline visibly that they can see in the room, taking images of the books that we're reading, putting them up on this timeline, and then as you start to build names, dates, and places in, putting them up as well. Another idea, of course, would be having kids construct a timeline, which I think is always a wonderful activity. They start to have a visual sense of where things fit. There's a great timeline in the back of the Omnibus textbook, which is obviously helpful.
Our kids' playroom is a 50-foot timeline that we've been doing for 11 years, and it has all that on it. Composers and artists and the books they're reading, and it's so neat, because now they're older and they've got a little drawing, but we keep adding to it.
We'll have to have you come to the school and teach us how to do it. And in fact, that's what we've been kicking around, is making that curricular. You know, making that activity curricular. It does present a challenge for teachers. Teachers have to take it upon themselves to provide some of the grammar of history. I think sometimes we might make the mistake that we assume that you get past the grammar stage and now you're in the logic and rhetoric stage, so therefore you leave the grammar stage behind. I think that's a false assumption. I think you bring the grammar stage up into the richness of the logic and rhetoric stage rather than leaving it behind. So we don't leave those things behind. What's interesting is they're going to start remembering names, dates, and places maybe in a more rich and holistic way, because those names, dates, and places will now be part of a living world, a book that they've read in which the characters have come alive. And so you've certainly already been doing that in the grammar stage, but the Omnibus is a great opportunity for those names, dates, and places to start taking on flesh. And so how do we do this? Well, this is what I said I was going to talk about, and I'm certainly going to start here. But I think history and historical context is richer, obviously, than just names, dates, and places. So one of the things to consider is when we read a book, where are we in history? What's taking place around the book? Now, for some of our books, this immediately creates a problem. I'll give you an instance, the Song of Roland. Where are we in history? Well, there's where we are when the book was written. Okay, and there's also the time period that the book covers. The Song of Roland, of course, is written much later than the time period that it covers. So, Song of Roland's written down during the First Crusade. Now you have an opportunity to talk a little bit about the First Crusade. Is there a relationship between the story and the First Crusade? That's another possibility. The style, it inhabits a particular period of time, which means it's going to have a particular style. A Song of Deeds. But of course, the story is about Charlemagne and the 12 peers, and of course, especially Roland. So it's also about the 8th and 9th centuries. And you could say that creates a problem where you could say, wow, this is a wonderful opportunity to talk about the First Crusade and to talk about Charlemagne. And to begin to include, we've got to revise this term jelly. I don't know if jelly is the right word. But the things that surround the text and also that connect the texts as you're moving through the omnibus curriculum. And so the neat thing about the Song of Roland is, even though the Song of Roland is more literature than it is history, but it provides a neat opportunity to do history. And I think in doing the history, the literature becomes more rich. And in doing the literature, the history becomes more rich. One of the things I like to do at the beginning is to give them an idea of important dates that surround the book, especially the time period that the book covers. Many of you know, if you've done Omnibus 2, that it's about a battle that was actually not between Charlemagne and a Muslim army, but between Charlemagne and the Basques. I don't know that that's very important. That can be introduced. But there are dates that surround the text that put the book in a certain place, put the story in a certain place. I think at this point, here's a great opportunity to bring the cards in, the things you've done in grammar school. Here's a great opportunity to plot this on a timeline. Here's a great opportunity for the book to be situated in a particular time and a particular place. And in so doing, I think it starts to acquire three dimensions. It becomes three-dimensional. What I've found is really helpful is when you're introducing these things. Now, of course, you could just introduce them like this, and I don't know. It's helpful. But I think there's even a richer way to do this. And Dr. Munson was talking in the lecture prior to mine about masculinity in the arts. The arts have become effeminized, or in the minds of our boys, they don't want to think about the arts because the arts are girly things. And I think that obviously that's harmful. Part of the reason why is because when they think of poetry, the first thing that comes to mind is a Hallmark card or some kitschy piece of literature, but not the Iliad. It's odd for them to think that the Iliad is a poem. It's odd for them to think that Beowulf is a poem. And so, in a way, I think there needs to be a removal of some of the false assumptions about the arts that our boys have. This picture here from Albrecht Dürer I use to talk about Charlemagne. And they'll never forget Charlemagne holding a sword and a globe with a cross. That image is indelibly printed in their mind. But it really is true that this becomes now a wonderful teaching tool. There are lots of little mysteries in this painting that Dürer painted into this painting. First of all, it's an opportunity to introduce art. So you're sneaking things in. They're not aware. Important elements in the painting. Obviously, the name of Charlemagne, Charles the Great, the Latinized name of Charlemagne. The crown, which is part of this papal coronation, which is a wonderful opportunity to introduce the phenomenon of papal coronation, which, in order to understand the Middle Ages, it's absolutely necessary to understand the phenomenon of papal coronation. So even introducing the crown, there's a great This is, I think it was Otto the Third. If any of you know, you may correct me. It's a very famous papal crown. But you can see, there's no doubt that Durer's papal crown is modeled after this papal crown. So this is a crown that Charlemagne wore as a result of being crowned by Pope Leo. Ah, this is wonderful. The victory globe. Now you're going to have the opportunity to talk about Omnibus One. That pagan emperors had images of Nike or victory holding a globe. Christian, especially Byzantine emperors, come along and place a cross on the globe. And the emperor, not Nike, is often holding the globe. This is kind of interesting. These are coins minted during Justinian's reign. On the left, you have Justin and Justinian. On the right, you have Nike holding a globe and a cross. Now, there's clearly no accident that Durer's painting, you have Nike holding a globe and a cross, and almost like a crozier, a sword in the right hand of Nike. If you go back, you can see now Charlemagne is a great Byzantine emperor, or he's a great Western emperor, recalling Constantine, Justinian. So now you have a connection to Omnibus One, or things you've done earlier in the year in Omnibus Two. And of course the sword that Charlemagne and kings, medieval kings, are protectors of Christendom. His job is to protect Christendom. And so this painting becomes an opportunity to do history. The image of Charlemagne's indelibly printed in their mind. Papal coronation, victory globe, the sword, and suddenly who Charlemagne is in the story, who Charlemagne is in history, who Charlemagne is in relation to Christendom, what medieval king, how medieval Christian kings were viewed, comes alive. And I think it helps Roland to start to have three dimensions. First of all, it is an awkward form for them to read. So part of the problem is getting them to be convinced that this is a book worth reading, I think does necessitate in some sense making them aware that the book is richer than what they might immediately see on the surface. Okay. Second aspect, I think cultural artifacts are very important. I'd give Beowulf as an example of this. How do we properly contextualize or make the books that we read three-dimensional? The Mead Hall. I spend a lot of time talking about the Mead Hall with my boys. Part of the reason why is that it's only in understanding the culture of the Mead Hall that the story starts to come alive, that the problem of Hrothgar's Mead Hall being ravaged by this monster comes alive, that this Anglo-Saxon culture or this Viking culture comes alive, and the necessity of Beowulf as a hero, all these things start to come alive just from imagining the Mead Hall. I think the Mead Hall is, in a way, it's the image that dominates the story, in a way, or it's certainly the image that dominates the opening of the story. But also for boys, first of all, I don't know if you've seen the Lord of the Rings, Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings movies. I think that Rohan is clearly Beowulfian, if I may. But So this is a picture. You can get this on the internet. I got this off the internet. I like them to draw them, and I have students who are very talented, and I'm certain could do better than this. But just introducing some of the artifacts. You know, what's the Mead Hall? What goes on in a Mead Hall? What's the culture of the Mead Hall like? Becomes a kind of precursor. It sets the backdrop for the story, but the culture of the Mead Hall actually is a huge part of the story. So that the fact that this great Mead Hall is being ravaged, if you don't understand how terrible it is for Hrothgar's Mead Hall to be ravaged by this monster, a lot of the movement in the story, a lot of the tension, a lot of the what's at stake in this culture doesn't emerge. So imagining the Mead Hall, I found, is a really important part of this. What I'll often say is, a king is as great as his Mead Hall. A king is as great as his ability to give great gifts, which you can see displayed in the Mead Hall. The heroic deeds that are sung skillfully, the quantity and quality of the meat and drink, the quality of the gifts that are given. So the Mead Hall is a culture. The interesting thing that emerges, though, is how do you keep the culture going? That question, what keeps this culture moving, introduces a problem. We know, if you know the background of Beowulf, that it's a clash between two worlds, Christendom and an Anglo-Saxon culture. And the story probably emerged prior to a Christian telling it. It probably emerged as a pagan story. And then a Christian tells the story and introduces Christian elements into the story. And you see a clash of worlds, but you can't really see the clash of worlds unless you understand what keeps this culture going. And if we're going to introduce theological context, which I'll talk about later, if you're going to present a theological critique of this world, you have to understand how it works and what keeps it moving. And so, interestingly enough, you start talking about the Mead Hall, and you can ask questions. Well, you know, how are you going to get a bunch of songs? Where are the deeds going to come from for the songs? Where are the gifts going to come from? Where's this treasure hoard going to come from? Where the meat and drink? Where does all of this come from? What keeps this culture moving? And what's at stake in this being lost? So you have this idea of great kings being benefactors, build this great Mead Hall, great gift givers. But then you introduce the thanes of the king. Great warriors have the greatest gifts. They're the most decorated. And a sort of relationship between kings and warriors emerges. This is actually a reconstruction of an Anglo-Saxon harp from the Sutton Hoo dig. Some of you may know this artist. There's a man who has reconstructed how Beowulf might have sounded using an Anglo-Saxon harp reconstructed from the Sutton Hoo dig. Sings in Old English. Does anyone remember? Have any of you heard him? Yeah. Absolutely wonderful. One of the things I do with the kids is I get them to see the cadence of the story, hear the alliteration, the masculine, the guttural quality of these sounds, which is very foreign. But suddenly, this isn't just this, a book that's, written on paper. It's a story that came out of a world that was rich in culture. A ring hoard. What's a ring hoard? I mentioned to them players in the Ohio State Buckeyes who have lots of Buckeyes on their helmets. A decorated, colonel and the greatest thanes have the greatest ring hoards. And nobody in Hrothgar's kingdom, none of his great thanes can stop this monster. And here comes this yacht across the sea, this Swede. I'm a Swede, so there's a part of me, my heart swells, and comes across the sea. to save the poor Danes. The torque that Wealhtheow gives to Beowulf. So you can include these elements that I think help the story, again, to acquire a sort of three-dimensional quality. Literary genre, once again, Beowulf. You know, Beowulf, of course, would probably be taught primarily as a book of literature, not as a history or theology text, obviously. So doing Beowulf provides the opportunity to introduce its literary genre. Well, it's epic historic narrative. We can remind them that the Anglo-Saxons had their epic historic narrative in the same way that the Greeks and the Romans did. And they've in Omnibus One read plenty of epic historic narrative. You know, the opportunity to talk about the structure. The Seamus Heaney translation is wonderful because the Old English is on the left. And the kids just love finding words that are close. And that's kind of an interesting phenomenon. They something starts English, Angleland, Anglo, you know, and a little light goes on. So introducing the literary element of the story, and again, this is part of making it three-dimensional. This is part of giving it depth and richness. The kenning. Oh, boy, I love kennings. You know, you could say, be utilitarian about it, the kenning is necessary in order to fulfill the alliterative demands on each line and so on and so forth. But it's certainly, that's not what a kenning is. A kenning gives a poem a living quality. Things don't just have one name. We like to make certain that our things have one name and not many. But I'll show you some examples. If you're familiar with Beowulf, you're aware of some of these wonderful kennings. The sea is a whale road or a swan road. The Danes are shield Danes, ring Danes, bright Danes, spear Danes. Greatest king is not just a king, he's a ring giver. And the greatest retainers, of course, would have a ring hoard. Bards have a word hoard. Great bards have the greatest word hoard. The body is a bone house. A battle is an iron shower or an arrow storm. The sun is a sky candle or a world candle or heaven's gem. A deer is a heath stepper. And to me, Beowulf's a very masculine poem. The poem has a kind of mass and substance to it. And it reflects the culture. There's a reason why it has this mass and substance to it. It's not a silly, kitschy thing. And I think that you can see good poetry has gravity. It has substance. You know, if Beowulf is great, they can see what's bad in bad poetry. And by the way, it took me a while to think Beowulf was great. I didn't like it at first. I didn't like it until I actually started to think of it in this broader sense. So actually, this was in a way a kind of conversion in me to enjoying Beowulf. It didn't come alive as a wonderful story until I started to think of it in this respect. So. Theological context. Obviously, this is the big ticket item. And where I think we've failed as Christians in the past is letting theology kind of be a sideshow. It's a kind of deus ex machina that sweeps down at the end and solves all problems, but it's kind of naturally irrelevant to the story, to the flow of history. And one critique of Omnibus is that, well, your Bible program drops out. And I understand that critique. I think it's incredible that in Omnibus 2 we read Athanasius is on the Incarnation, and we also read the Gospel of John. So when you're talking about what's at stake in Nicene Christology, when you're talking about what's at stake in Athanasius contra Mundi, Athanasius against the whole world, you read the Gospel of John, and then you read Athanasius alongside John, he becomes a hero, and a new kind of hero. In fact, a hero that we can compare to the heroism of Beowulf. Poor Athanasius getting shipped off and coming back and getting shipped off and coming back. This little man who is just, you know, obviously unbelievably rhetorically gifted and had just this adamantine heart stubborn even. But reading the Gospel of John alongside on the Incarnation, I can't tell you how much meaning the Gospel of John acquires for the kids. Okay. Clovis is baptized in 500. You know, it's kind of an important event. Ethelbert's wife, Bertha, is of Merovingian nobility and is a Christian. Ethelbert's kind of interested in this strange faith that his wife has. He's actually allowed her to take some of the ruins of churches and restore them, asks missionaries to come to Angoland to give a reasoned account of his wife's faith. They've already gotten this, by the way, in Bede. Gaul is becoming a pipeline for missionary activity to Britain. And really importantly, Nicene missionary activity. Most of the Germanic barbarians, by the way, had converted to an Arian form of Christianity and had held an Arian Christology. The baptism of Clovis becomes a really important event. It actually relates to our story almost in a sidelong way, but Pope Gregory sends Augustine of Canterbury to Britain to preach the Orthodox Nicene faith to Ethelbert and his subjects. Ethelbert converts, 10,000 of his subjects convert. Clearly, Ethelbert's wife being descended of this Merovingian nobility is important. But you don't get Beowulf, you don't get a Christian writing Beowulf without all of this. You don't get the Christian interpolation or the Christian intrusion into a pagan story without this. And they've gotten this already from Bede. So this events in Bede and the things that are happening in Bede are related to Beowulf. And the culture clash and the confrontation between Christianity and Germanic paganism is in part, you can see what God is doing in history in this story. You know, this provides, of course, an opportunity to talk about the Anglo-Saxon invasion. Vortigern inviting soldiers in. And then eventually, of course, Britain being overtaken by Jutes and Angles and Saxons. The map part of this is, I think, kind of important. The Angles invade, and they can see clearly this old story got over to Great Britain, but then it encountered Christianity. And so there's, you know, I suspect this is probably where Beowulf began. It migrated here and it runs into Christianity. So there's a story, a backstory to Beowulf, which the theological context then, in part, is that whole backstory. What is God doing in history? And how does that backstory relate to what's going on in Beowulf? That monsters come from Cain. Cain is an outcast. Grendel's an outcast. Grendel's mother's an outcast. That monsters are sea creatures, made it through the flood. So you can see there's, you know, this collision between these two stories, and it makes the story fascinating. I think that to get to the richness of the theological context, you often need the cultural context. You need the historical context. So that you can't just drop in theological relevance. I think that it emerges often out of the richness of what's taking place in the medieval world. You know, what's the relevance of the Council of Nicaea to Beowulf? Well, it's not immediately relevant, but the fact that that Christianity and Anglo-Saxon paganism are coming, you know, to a sort of collision does have something to do with the Council of Nicaea. Fundamental problem with Anglo-Saxon culture. Cycle of violence. Great kings are great gift givers. Question naturally arises, well, where do they get their stuff? Treasure hoard. Great warriors receive great gifts and have great songs sung about them. Where do these things come from? Battle. So the culture of the mead hall is related to this culture of violence. And that's part of the interesting collision that takes place when Christianity encounters Beowulf's culture. Could an ambiguity towards violence that didn't previously exist emerge? And what role would Christianity play in that? Can Christian warriors have the kind of battle lust that a Germanic barbarian can have? If you're converted, does your battle lust have to change? Do you have to fight differently? Is chivalry actually an outgrowth of Christianity trying to ameliorate some of the harshness of the life of a warrior? You can see that begin. Those things come, you know, when you get to Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. Those questions start to emerge, and you get to chivalry. What does Christianity do to ameliorate some of the harshness of the violence of warfare? This book is kind of, I think, raises that question. It doesn't answer the question. It just raises it. This culture needs warfare. And an interesting thing emerges as you look at the story, the decline in Beowulf. Beowulf first tears Grendel's arm off. Then he goes to Grendel's mother's lair, and he's about to be killed. And it seems like a throwaway line, but the Lord lifted him up, and he's got this sword that, you know, breaks over the top of Grendel's mother's head. He has to get this sword from the giants that was hewn way back when. That's in her treasure hoard, and then of course the dragon kills him, and you see the decline of Beowulf. Did Christianity play a role in that? Does the Christian telling the story leave the end of that story, make the end of that story so tragic? No one's going to replace Beowulf. The Swedes are going to sweep down, and the culture is probably going to die. Can you sustain this culture? Those kinds of questions emerge, but they emerge because the book has become three-dimensional, I think. I don't know why I put that in there. Because I'm a Swede. A question arises, is the pagan heroic ideal compatible with the heroic model of Christ? Are we saying warfare is inherently bad? No. Are we saying warfare is inherently good? No. Where does just war theory come? Do Vikings need just war theory? I mean, clearly no. So the fact that Christians start to think about these things, the amelioration of violence the mitigation of some of the harshness. Where does that come from? What role does Christianity play in that? And then another question arises, do we just want our boys... Okay, so we have a problem with in our culture with masculinity. Do we just want to give them swords? Is that the answer? I think sometimes we mistakenly think that's the answer. I mean, my son, the reason why I wanted to go to Veritas is the first 5 or 6 times we drove by, kids were after school having sword fights. And he thought, I guess that's what you do. This is a school where you go have sword fights. So I'm certainly not saying that that's bad, but, you know, Christianity introduces a challenge to the pagan heroic model. And I think the hard thing for us to do is to say, is Christ a hero? And if so, can Christ be heroic enough to challenge the heroism of Beowulf? Because once you get Beowulf on the scene, tearing arms off, it's pretty hard to suggest that Christ is more heroic. We make Beowulf's arm, and Grendel's arm, and it's kind of hanging up in our room, and there's sinews coming out, and the kids love doing that. But it is a challenge. Are they going to think, boy, Christ is sort of mild, meek, milquetoast, meek compared to Beowulf? So what is Christian heroism? What does it look like? They've already gotten some of this in Eusebius. But one thing I think to point out is that the warrior code finds it very difficult to make it's very difficult to understand Christ. One of the earliest instances of graffiti aimed at Christians, I don't know if any of you have seen this, is, I'll see if I get this right. It says something to the effect of, Anaximenos worships his God. And there's a picture of Christ on the cross. It's a Roman that's incredulous. How could this be your God? That doesn't make any sense. This is inconceivable to us that you worship a guy who died on the cross. That's not conceivable. So the theological context, once they understand the warrior code, what keeps this culture going, what is the relationship between Christian heroism and the heroism that we see in this pagan culture? For instance, I think part of the reason why Islam rejects the crucifixion, there are other more deeper theological reasons, but is that Allah wouldn't allow his prophet to be humiliated like that. Jesus, of course, is a prophet in Islam. He wouldn't allow his prophet to be humiliated like that. You can die in battle, that's great, but you can't die on a cross. That's terrible. So that question of how is Christ's death heroic emerges. You know, one great question that you can start to ask is this heroism less heroic? You know, if they've read the great passage in Eusebius, Polycarp, is Polycarp less heroic? I don't think so. I mean, you read the great passage in Polycarp. Polycarp doesn't seem any less heroic than any great pagan hero. Stephen Stoning. Athanasius, Jim Elliot for a modern example. This is my grandfather's funeral. I read this line from Dostoevsky. It's from Brothers Karamazov. A loving humility is a terrible power. Nothing can compare with it. So it's not as though humility is weakness. Humility is actually a power. So now the question of, well, what's power? You know, is it overpowering someone with an axe, a battle axe? Is it battle lust? It starts to emerge. Beowulf doesn't answer the question. One of the great things about Omnibus is not all these questions are canned and get answered immediately. They're open. And the books do a great job of now making biblical answers all the more relevant. Romans 1:16, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. It's the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes, first for the Jew, then for the Gentile. In other words, the gospel is not like not powerful. It's power versus weakness, or it's power. I mean, the paradox of the meek inheriting the earth is that it is power. It's just a different kind of power. This is, of course, a wonderful God has chosen the foolish things of the world to put to shame the wise. He's chosen the weak things of the world to put to shame the things which are mighty. So that, of course, it's His strength. It's His power. And we're vessels of that. But I think as the books become three-dimensional, theological context, historical context, those things become more relevant. And the books become more, the conversations are more natural. You're not just kind of suddenly asking, you know, a Bible passage to comment on Beowulf in a way that it's unnaturally or doesn't seem naturally capable of doing. Of course, there's always an opportunity to do art. Dr. Munson was saying that a beautiful part of the curriculum is the kids exploring the arts, learning to pick things out, find things, see things, but also imagining what's Polycarp's martyrdom like, what's the stoning of Stephen like. There are many great instances, of course, this is Caravaggio's martyrdom of St. Peter. So you do have opportunities to do art history alongside your final loose ends. Geography. Don't know if any of you have had this experience. I love maps. I think that another part of a book becoming three-dimensional is maps. You can talk all you want about Alaric invading Rome, but until they have kind of a picture of the Goths migrating, it doesn't come alive. This is, of course, a picture of the migration of the Goths and the story, the Battle of Adrianople, in which Valens is killed, one of the most shocking moments. In fact, probably a lot more shocking than this, you know, that an emperor is killed by Goths. So this is a precursor event, and you see them sort of traveling, marauding as they travel, and making their way to Rome and sacking Rome. One thing that this you can do on this map is you can say, well, they got pushed here by the Huns. The Huns came sweeping in, and the Goths were terrified of the Huns. And so they ended up really, in a way, being forced to have a treaty with Valens, and then there was a famine, and Valens kept food from them. But you can see the map helps these things to come alive as well. And I think the map can always be an opportunity to do history. You can annotate the map. I love to have the kids draw maps and then annotate them. Where did the Huns come from? You know, where's the Danube? I suspect that most of our kids don't know where the Danube is. By the way, don't ask me what Ghana's doing circled down there. I have no idea. under Justinian, the brief recovery of the Western Empire. What is Byzantium? You know, how did it stop being the Roman Empire and become Byzantium? I think most kids think they're told the Roman Empire fell, and the date, you know, whatever the traditional date they're given is, from 410, you know, all the way up into the 6th century. Okay, the Roman Empire fell then. Well, wait a minute. No, it didn't. It was very strong for a long time. In fact, it was strong for a long time, and it held the line against Muslim invasion for a long time. So we call it Byzantium, but that itself is unknown to most kids. In fact, I think it's the Middle Ages is a neglected part of history. In fact, I must confess that when Ty told me that I'd be teaching the Middle Ages section, I dropped my head, and I thought, please give me ancient or modern. And it's turned out to be my favorite. So anyway, maps, I think, are a forgotten component, and I think they're very helpful in helping to round out and make the curriculum three-dimensional. questions.
You make a good case for putting all of the omnibus in a contextual setting. It really does rich in everything. But as a homeschooling mom, I'm trying to teach five subjects, all in different areas, not just history, but math and the like. Do you have an idea of what kind of resources are available to help someone in that predicament to draw out this kind of depth?
You know, I would actually not be a very good person to help you in that regard, because I haven't come at it in that way. What I have realized, I sometimes work on the phones over the summer in the press, that there's such an incredible network of people doing this. I've been doing it, you know, in the context of the school. I haven't been doing it at home. I bet there are people in this room who'd be more helpful than me. I do think the book, sometimes things are lost. The book does have helps. I don't know if you've used the timelines at all. It certainly does. And of course, a lot of the things that they got, like the historical timeline narrative that they got back in grammar school, just haven't been carried over. So I think you don't actually have to reinvent the wheel in most cases. I would suggest Bible and history cards, you know, the history of time, timeline narrative, all that stuff really kind of needs to be carried over. In fact, we're thinking about that at the school right now, how we can more explicitly do that so that all the, you know, things that they're getting there are carried over. So I would say that there probably are a lot of resources. This is my own thing, and I would also say that, you know, don't be surprised. It took me about 2 years to do this, but, you know, you can start small and just build over time, but I even think the littlest things make the biggest difference. So this might look exotic, but it really doesn't have to be that exotic. I mean, it can be as simple as a couple paintings, the timeline, maps.
I think the hardest part is finding the time to draw that all together when you are switching. You spend a week or maybe 2 weeks in a work, and then you have another one on top of you to do again. So.
And I do this full time, and you do that full time, and full time mom. So you have a challenge I don't have, which I appreciate. So, Ty? Yeah, that's a challenge. And I do think that an interesting part of this too is having the kids do some of the legwork. You know, that get them to the library and, you know, doing the, I don't know how you did the timeline. Yeah. Making maps, you know, I think.
Yeah. I mean, and I just realized it was a little bit of time. Yeah. And in fact, they remember just one thing, but then it's amazing how it accumulates.
Yeah. And I, you know, just to encourage you, I'd say that even a few artifacts go a really long way. You know, the painting of Charlemagne, all I have to say is protector of Christendom, the image comes to mind immediately. So even a few artifacts, I think, go a long way.
Also into them, and that is There are so many, you know, as we're developing curriculums and learning how to use them in different circumstances, whether it's traditional homeschooling or a study center like Blackboard or a school setting, there have developed so many Yahoo lists and forums. You know, I'm a writing teacher. I use the IEW forum every single day.
You don't mean Yahoo as in strange characters?
No,
or
no.
Just kidding.
those people have done this before. And they have links. They have pages of stuff.
Absolutely.
And they're sharing.
Yeah.
Does that exist for all of us?
Not yet. I think we were actually in the car talking about this very thing, figuring out a way to do that when we do four, maybe. Yeah, you're right. It probably does, and I'm not aware of it, but.
My question was, it's the example of the third painting, and then also the theology. It seems that the structure of this is very historically focused on the traditional understanding of history in terms of events and such, and obviously you're not going to be able to talking about Charlemagne, and then you bring up the third painting. You're not going to then go and explore Dutch Renaissance painting right there.
Right.
Like that wouldn't really make any sense. But likewise, when you're bringing in these biblical passages, you're not going to then say, "Well, let's quick do a couple days on systematic theology."
Right. Absolutely.
How do you see those? Do you see those as being appropriately separate subjects?
I know exactly what you're saying. One advantage we have is we've got a guy, Matt Clark, who comes in, and we have Fridays devoted to doing art history. So he'll go through. In fact, his favorite period is Dutch Renaissance. He'll go through and he'll talk about in Italy. The Italians looked down their noses at what was going on in the Dutch Renaissance and oil painting. I mean, so he comes in and he does a lot of that, and it's really wonderful. I mean, you're right, I couldn't do it. Curricularly, I couldn't do it. So I think it does need to come in along the side. Systematic theology, it's kind of built into the text in some respects. In another sense, it really is a work that we have to do. And so I think there are these kind of, I don't want to call them extracurricular because they're really important, but there is a sense in which if you do omnibus well, you seem not to be able to do other things. It's a kind of six of one, half dozen. No, it's not that. It's that it's a terrible metaphor. It's that if you do this well, it's going to create certain limitations over here. And so we have the good fortune of having Matt doing those lectures. Systematic theology, it's a passion of mine, so I try to introduce it where possible. In certain books, you know, obviously when we're doing the creeds, it's very relevant.
I don't even mean necessarily systematic theology, but say just looking at the
doctrine.
The structure of how the Bible progresses from Old Testament to New Testament, and you can't deal with that when you're looking at it purely from a...
Well, we do in a way, because we do go through, we start in Genesis and we read, you know, most of the Bible. I mean, we read a good chunk of the Bible in omnibus. So we'll actually, if we're reading Kings, 1st and 2nd Kings, it's explicitly devoted to that. So when we're reading John, you know, it's explicitly devoted to reading John in that way.
How do you order that? Like, do you do basically all your Bible reading in the ancient section of omnibus?
You know what, Ty? Do you want to answer that? Because you know omnibus infinitely better than I do.
Mm-hmm.